but never without an estimation of the cost and a willingness to pay it. Would he have thought drawing me back to Lallybroch worth the chance of actually dying? That hardly seemed logical, and Jamie Fraser was a very logical man. I pulled the hood of my cloak further over my head to keep the increasing downpour out of my face. Young Ian's shoulders and thighs were dark with wet, and the rain dripped from the brim of his slouch hat, but he sat straight in the saddle, ignoring the weather with the stoic nonchalance of a true-born Scot. Very well. Given that Jamie likely hadn't shot himself, was he shot at all? He might have made up the story and sent his nephew to tell it. On consideration, though, I thought it highly unlikely that young Ian could have delivered the news so convincingly were it false. I shrugged, the movement sending a cold rivulet down inside the front of my cloak, and set myself to wait with what patience I could for the journey to be ended. Years in the practice of medicine had taught me not to anticipate. The reality of each case was bound to be unique, and so must be my response to it. My emotions, however, were much harder to control than my professional reactions. Each time I had left Lallybroch, I had thought I would never return. Now here I was, going back once more. Twice now I had left Jamie, knowing with certainty that I would never see him again. And yet here I was, going back to him like a bloody homing pigeon to its loft. "I'll tell you one thing, Jamie Fraser," I muttered under my breath. "If you aren't at death's door when I get there, you'll live to regret it." Chapter 36. Practical and Applied Witchcraft. It was several hours past dark when we arrived at last, soaked to the skin. The house was silent and dark, save for two dimly lighted windows downstairs in the parlour. There was a single warning bark from one of the dogs, but young Ian shushed the animal, and after a quick, curious nosing at my stirrup, the black and white shape faded back into the darkness of the dooryard. The warning had been enough to alert someone. As young Ian led me into the hall, the door to the parlour opened. Jenny poked her head out, her face drawn with worry. At the sight of young Ian, she popped out into the hallway, her expression transformed to one of joyous relief, at once superseded by the righteous anger of a mother confronted by an errant offspring. "Ian, you wee wretch," she said. "Where have you been all this time? Your da and I have been worried sick for you." She paused long enough to look him over anxiously. "You're all right." At his nod, her lips grew tight again. "Aye, well, you're for it now, laddie, I'll tell you. And just where the devil have you been, anyway?" Gangling, knob-jointed, and dripping wet, young Ian looked like nothing so much as a drowned scarecrow, but he was still large enough to block me from his mother's view. He didn't answer Jenny's scolding, but shrugged awkwardly and stepped aside, exposing me to his mother's startled gaze. If my resurrection from the dead had disconcerted her, this second reappearance stunned her. Her deep blue eyes, normally as slanted as her brother's, opened so wide they looked round. She stared at me for a long moment without saying anything, then her gaze swiveled once more to her son. "A cuckoo," she said, almost conversationally. "That's what you are, laddie, a great cuckoo in the nest. God knows whose son you were meant to be. It wasna mine." Young Ian flushed hotly, dropping his eyes as the red burned in his cheeks. He pushed the feathery, damp hair out of his eyes with the back of one hand. He began, eyes on his boots. "I couldn't have just..." "Oh, never mind about it now," his mother snapped. "Get you upstairs to your bed. Your da will deal with you in the morning." Ian glanced helplessly at the parlour door, then at me. He shrugged once more, looking at the sodden hat in his hands as though wondering how it had got there, and shuffled slowly down the hall. Jenny stood quite still, eyes fixed on me, until the padded door at the end of the hallway closed with a soft thump behind young Ian. Her face showed lines of strain, and the shadows of sleeplessness smudged her eyes. Still fine-boned and erect, for once she looked her age and more. "So you're back," she said flatly. Seeing no point in answering the obvious, I nodded briefly. The house was quiet around us and full of shadows, the hallway lighted only by a three-pronged candlestick set on the table. "Never mind about it now," I said softly, so as not to disturb the house's slumber. There was, after all, only one thing of importance at the moment. "Where's Jamie?" After a small hesitation, she nodded as well, accepting my presence for the moment. "In there," she said, waving toward the parlour door. I started toward the door, then paused. There was the one thing more. "Where's Lyra?" I asked. "Gone," she said. Her eyes were flat and dark in the candlelight, unreadable. I nodded in response and stepped through the door, closing it gently but firmly behind me. Too long to be laid on the sofa, Jamie lay on a camp bed set up before the fire. Asleep or unconscious, his profile rose dark and sharp-edged against the light of the glowing coals, unmoving. Whatever he wasn't dead, at least not yet. My eyes growing accustomed to the dim light of the fire, I could see the slow rise and fall of his chest beneath nightshirt and quilt. A flask of water and a brandy bottle sat on the small table by the bed. The padded chair by the fire had a shawl thrown over its back. Jenny had been sitting there, watching over her brother. There seemed no need now for haste. I untied the strings at the neck of my cloak and spread the soggy garment over the chair back, taking the shawl in substitute. My hands were cold. I put them under my arms, hugging myself, to bring them to something like a normal temperature before I touched him. When I did venture to place a thawed hand on his forehead, I nearly jerked it back. He was hot as a just-fired pistol, and he twitched and moaned at my touch. Fever indeed. I stood looking down at him for a moment, then carefully moved to the side of the bed and sat down in Jenny's chair. I didn't think he would sleep long, with a temperature like that, and it seemed a shame to wake him needlessly soon, merely to examine him. The cloak behind me dripped water on the floor, a slow, arrhythmic patting. It reminded me unpleasantly of an old Highland superstition, the death drop. Just before a death occurs, the story goes, the sound of water dripping is heard in the house by those sensitive to such things. I wasn't, thank heaven, subject to noticing supernatural phenomena of that sort. "No," I thought wryly. "It takes something like a crack through time to get your attention." The thought made me smile, if only briefly, and dispelled the frisson I had felt at the thought of the death drop. As the rain chill left me, though, I still felt uneasy, and for obvious reasons. It wasn't that long ago that I had stood by another makeshift bed deep in the night watches and contemplated death and the waste of a marriage. The thoughts I had begun in the wood hadn't stopped on the hasty journey back to Lallybroch, and they continued now without my conscious volition. Honour had led Frank to his decision to keep me as his wife and raise Brianna as his own. Honour and an unwillingness to decline a responsibility he felt was his. Well, here before me lay another honourable man. Lyra and her daughters, Jenny and her family, the Scots prisoners, the smugglers, Mr. Willoughby and Geordie, Fergus and the tenants. How many other responsibilities had Jamie shouldered through our years apart? Frank's death had absolved me of one of my own obligations. Brianna herself, of another. The hospital board, in their eternal wisdom, had severed the single great remaining tie that bound me to that life. I had had time, with Joe Abernathy's help, to relieve myself of the smaller responsibilities, to depute and delegate, divest and resolve. Jamie had had neither warning nor choice about my reappearance in his life. no time to make decisions or resolve conflicts. And he was not one to abandon his responsibilities, even for the sake of love. Yes, he'd lied to me, hadn't trusted me to recognize his responsibilities, to stand by him, or to leave him, as his circumstances demanded. He'd been afraid. So had I. Afraid that he wouldn't choose me, confronted with the struggle between a 20-year-old love and a present-day family. So, I'd run away.
Who are you jiving, LJ?
I heard Joe Abernathy's voice say, derisive and affectionate. I had fled toward Craigner Dunn with all the speed and decision of a condemned felon approaching the steps of the gallows. Nothing had slowed my journey but the hope that Jamie would come after me. True, the pangs of conscience and wounded pride had spurred me on, but the one moment when young Ian had said, "He's dying," had shown those up for the flimsy things they were. My marriage to Jamie had been for me like the turning of a great key, each small turn setting in play the intricate fall of tumblers within me. Bree had been able to turn that key as well, edging closer to the unlocking of the door of myself. But the final turn of the lock was frozen, until I had walked into the print shop in Edinburgh, and the mechanism had sprung free with a final decisive click. The door now was ajar, the light of an unknown future shining through its crack. But it would take more strength than I had alone to push it open. I watched the rise and fall of his breath, and the play of light and shadow on the strong, clean lines of his face, and knew that nothing truly mattered between us but the fact that we both still lived. So here I was, again. And whatever the cost of it might be to him or me, here I stayed. I didn't realize that his eyes had opened until he spoke.
"You came back then," he said softly. "I knew you would."
I opened my mouth to reply, but he was still talking, eyes fixed on my face, pupils dilated to pools of darkness.
"My love," he said, almost whispering. "God, you do look so lovely, with your great eyes all gold and your hair so soft round your face."
He brushed his tongue across dry lips.
"I knew you must forgive me, Sasnach, once you knew."
Once I knew? My brow shot up, but I didn't speak. He had more to say.
"I was so afraid to lose you again, Mukria," he murmured. "So afraid I haven't loved anyone but you, Miss Asenach, never since the day I saw you. But I couldna bear."
His voice drifted off in an unintelligible mumble, and his eyes closed again, lashes lying dark against the high curve of his cheek. I sat still, wondering what I should do. As I watched, his eyes opened suddenly once more. Heavy and drowsy with fever, they sought my face.
"It will not be long, Sasnach," he said,
as though reassuring me. One corner of his mouth twitched in an attempt at a smile.
"Not long. Then I shall touch you once more. I do long to touch you."
"Oh, Jamie," I said. Moved by tenderness, I reached out and laid my hand along his burning cheek. His eyes snapped wide with shock, and he jerked bolt upright in bed, letting out a blood-curdling yell of anguish as the movement jarred his wounded arm.
"Oh, God! Oh, Christ! Oh, Jesus, Lord God Almighty!" he said, bent half-breathless and clutching at his left arm. "You're real! Bloody, stinking, filthy, pig-swiving hell! Oh, Christ!"
"Are you all right?" I said, rather inanely. I could hear startled exclamations from the floor above, muffled by the thick planks, and the thump of feet as one after another of Lallybroch's inhabitants leapt from their beds to investigate the uproar. Jenny's head, eyes even wider than before, poked through the parlour door. Jamie saw her, and somehow found sufficient breath to roar, "Get out!" before doubling up again with an agonised groan.
"Jesus!" he said,
between clenched teeth.
What in God's holy name are you doing here, Sassenach?
What do you mean, what am I doing here? I said. You sent for me. And what do you mean? I'm real.
He unclenched his jaw and tentatively loosened his grip on his left arm.
The resultant sensation proving unsatisfactory, he promptly grabbed it again and said several things in French, involving the reproductive organs of assorted saints and animals.
"For God's sake, lie down," I said.
I took him by the shoulders and eased him back onto the pillows, noting with some alarm how close his bones were to the surface of his heated skin.
"I thought you were a fever dream till you touched me," he said, gasping. "What in the hell do you mean, popping up by my bed and scaring me to death?"
He grimaced in pain.
"Christ! It feels like my damn arm's come off at the shoulder. Oh, bugger it!"
he exclaimed, as I firmly detached the fingers of his right hand from his left arm.
"Didn't you send young Ian to tell me you were dying?" I said, deftly rolling back the sleeve of his nightshirt. The arm was wound in a huge bandage above the elbow, and I groped for the end of the linen strip.
"Me? No! Ow! That hurts!"
"It'll hurt worse before I'm through with you," I said, carefully unwrapping.
"You mean the little bastard came after me on his own? You didn't want me to come back?"
"Want you back? No. Want you to come back to me for nothing but pity, the same as you might shoo for a dog in a ditch. Bloody hell. No, I forbade the little bugger to go after you."
He scowled furiously at me, ruddy brows knitting together. "I'm a doctor," I said coldly, "not a veterinarian. And if you didn't want me back, what was all that you were saying before you realised I was real, hmm? Bite the blanket or something. The end stuck, and I'm going to pull it loose."
He bit his lip instead, and made no noise but a swift intake of air through his nose. It was impossible to judge his colour in the firelight, but his eyes closed briefly, and small beads of sweat popped out on his forehead. I turned away for a moment, groping in the drawer of Jenny's desk where the extra candles were kept. I needed more light before I did anything.
"I suppose young Ian told me you were dying just to get me back here. He must have thought I wouldn't come otherwise."
The candles were there, fine beeswax from the Lallybroch hives.
"For what it's worth, I am dying."
His voice came from behind me, dry and blunt, despite his breathlessness. I turned back to him in some surprise. His eyes rested on my face quite calmly, now that the pain in his arm had lessened a bit. But his breath was still coming unevenly, and his eyes were heavy and bright with fever. I didn't respond at once, but lit the candles I had found, placing them in the big candelabra that usually decorated the sideboard, unused save for great occasions. The flames of five additional candles brightened the room as though in preparation for a party. I bent over the bed, non-committal.
"Let's have a look at it."
The wound itself was a ragged, dark hole scabbed at the edges and faintly blue-tinged. I pressed the flesh on either side of the wound. It was red and angry-looking, and there was a considerable seepage of pus. Jamie stirred uneasily as I drew my fingertips gently but firmly down the length of the muscle.
"You have the makings of a very fine little infection there, my lad," I said. "Young Ian said it went into your side. A second shot, or did it go through your arm?" "It went through. Jenny dug the ball out of my side. That wasn't so bad, though. Just an inch or so in."
He spoke in brief spurts, lips tightening involuntarily between sentences.
"Let me see where it went through."
Moving very slowly, he turned his hand to the outside, letting the arm fall away from his side. I could see that even that small movement was intensely painful. The exit wound was just above the elbow joint, on the inside of the upper arm. Not directly opposite the entrance wound, though. The ball had been deflected in its passage.
Hit the bone, I said, trying not to imagine what that must have felt like. Do you know if the bone's broken? I don't want to poke you more than I need to. Thanks for small mercies, he said, with an attempt at a smile. The muscles of his face trembled, though, and went slack with exhaustion. No, I think it's not broken, he said. I've broken my collarbone and my hand before, and it's no like that, though it hurts a bit.
I expect it does. I felt my way carefully up the swell of his biceps, testing for tenderness. How far up does the pain go? He glanced at his wounded arm, almost casually.
Feels like I've a hot poker in my arm, not a bone. But it's not just the arm pains me now. My whole side's gone stiff and sore.
He swallowed, licking his lips again.
Will you give me a taste of the brandy? He asked. It hurts to feel my heart beating, he added apologetically.
Without comment, I poured a cup of water from the flask on the table and held it to his lips. He raised one brow but drank thirstily, then let his head fall back against the pillow. He breathed deeply for a moment, eyes closed, then opened them and looked directly at me.
I've had two fevers in my life that near killed me, he said. I think this one likely will. I wouldn't have sinned for you, but I'm glad you're here.
He swallowed once, then went on.
I wanted to say to you that I'm sorry, and to bid you a proper farewell. I wouldn't ask you to stay till the end, but would you stay with me just for a bit?
His right hand was pressed flat against the mattress, steadying him. I could see that he was fighting hard to keep any note of pleading from his voice or eyes, to make it a simple request, one that could be refused. I sat down on the bed beside him, careful not to jar him. The firelight glowed on one side of his face, sparking the red-gold stubble of his beard, picking up the small flickers of silver here and there, leaving the other side masked in shadow. He met my eyes, not blinking. I hoped the yearning that showed in his face was not quite so apparent on my own. I reached out and ran a hand gently down the side of his face, feeling the soft scratchiness of beard stubble.
I'll stay for a bit, I said, but you're not going to die.
He raised one eyebrow.
You brought me through one bad fever using what I still think was witchcraft. And Jenny got me through the next with naught but plain stubbornness. I suppose with the both of you here, you might just manage it. But I'm no at all sure I want to go through such an ordeal again. I think I'd rather just die and he'd done with it, if it's all the same to you.
Ingrate, I said. Coward. Torn between exasperation and tenderness, I patted his cheek and stood up, groping in the deep pocket of my skirt. There was one item I had carried on my person at all times, not trusting it to the vagaries of travel. I laid the small flat case on the table and flipped the latch. "I'm not going to let you die this time either," I informed him, greatly as I may be tempted. I carefully extracted the roll of grey flannel and laid it on the table with a soft clinking noise. I unrolled the flannel, displaying the gleaming row of syringes, and rummaged in the box for the small bottle of penicillin tablets.
"What in God's name are those?" Jamie asked, eyeing the syringes with interest. "They look wicked sharp."
I didn't answer, occupied in dissolving the penicillin tablets in the vial of sterile water. I selected a glass barrel, fitted a needle, and pressed the tip through the rubber covering the mouth of the bottle. Holding it up to the light, I pulled back slowly on the plunger, watching the thick white liquid fill the barrel, checking for bubbles. Then, pulling the needle free, I depressed the plunger slightly until a drop of liquid purled from the point and rolled slowly down the length of the spike.
"Roll on to your good side," I said, turning to Jamie, "and pull up your shirt."
He eyed the needle in my hand with keen suspicion, but reluctantly obeyed.
I surveyed the terrain with approval. "Your bottom hasn't changed a bit in 20 years, I remarked, admiring the muscular curves.
"Neither has yours," he replied courteously, "but I'm no insisting you expose it. Are you suffering a sudden attack of lustfulness?"
"Not just at present," I said evenly, swabbing a patch of skin with a cloth soaked in brandy.
"That's a very nice make of brandy," he said, peering back over his shoulder, "but I'm more accustomed to apply it at the other end."
"It's also the best source of alcohol available. Hold still now and relax." I jabbed deftly and pressed the plunger slowly in.
"Ouch!"
Jamie rubbed his posterior resentfully. "It'll stop stinging in a minute." I poured an inch of brandy into the cup. "Now you can have a bit to drink. A very little bit." He drained the cup without comment, watching me roll up the collection of syringes. Finally, he said,
"I thought you stuck pins in ill-wish dolls when you meant to witch someone, not in the people themselves."
"It's not a pin. It's a hypodermic syringe."
"I don't care what you call it. It felt like a bloody horseshoe nail." "Would you care to tell me why jabbing pins in my arse is going to help my arm?"
I took a deep breath. "Well, do you remember my once telling you about germs?" He looked quite blank. "Little beasts, too small to see," I elaborated. "They can get into your body through bad food or water, or through open wounds. And if they do, they can make you ill." He stares at his arm with interest.
"Have germs in my arm, have I?"
"You very definitely have." I tapped a finger on the small flat box. "The medicine I just shot into your backside kills germs, though. You get another shot every 4 hours till this time tomorrow, and then we'll see how you're doing." I paused. Jamie was staring at me, shaking his head. "Do you understand?" I asked. He nodded slowly.
"Aye, I do. I should have let them burn ye 20 years ago."
Chapter 37. What's in a name? After giving him a shot and settling him comfortably, I sat watching until he fell asleep again, allowing him to hold my hand until his own grip relaxed in sleep and the big hand dropped slack by his side. I sat by his bed for the rest of the night, dozing sometimes, and rousing myself by means of the internal clock all doctors have, geared to the rhythms of a hospital's shift changes. 2 more shots, the last at daybreak, and by then the fever had loosed its hold perceptibly. He was still very warm to the touch, but his flesh no longer burned, and he rested easier, falling asleep after the last shot with no more than a few grumbles and a faint moan as his arm twinged. "Bloody 18th-century germs are no match for penicillin," I told his sleeping form. "No resistance. Even if you had syphilis, I'd have it cleaned up in no time." "And what then?" I wondered, as I staggered off to the kitchen in search of hot tea and food. A strange woman, presumably the cook or the housemaid, was firing up the brick oven, ready to receive the daily loaves that lay rising in their pans on the table. She didn't seem surprised to see me, but cleared away a small space for me to sit down, and brought me tea and fresh girdle cakes with no more than a quick, "Good morning to you, Mum," before returning to her work. Evidently, Jenny had informed the household of my presence. Did that mean she accepted it herself? I doubted it. Clearly, she had wanted me to go, and wasn't best pleased to have me back. If I was going to stay, there was plainly going to be a certain amount of explanation about Lyra, from both Jenny and Jamie. And I was going to stay. "Thank you," I said politely to the cook, and taking a fresh cup of tea with me, went back to the parlour to wait until Jamie saw fit to wake up again. People passed by the door during the morning, pausing now and then to peep through, but always went on hurriedly when I looked up. At last, Jamie showed signs of waking just before noon. He stirred, sighed, groaned as the movement jarred his arm, and subsided once more.
I gave him a few moments to realize that I was there, but his eyes stayed shut. He wasn't asleep, though. The lines of his body were slightly tensed, not relaxed in slumber. I had watched him sleep all night. I knew the difference.
All right, I said.
I leaned back in the chair, settling myself comfortably, well out of his reach.
Let's hear it, then.
A small slit of blue showed under the long auburn lashes, then disappeared again.
"Mmm,"
he said, pretending to wake slowly. The lashes fluttered against his cheeks.
"Don't stall," I said crisply. "I know perfectly well you're awake. Open your eyes and tell me about Lyra."
The blue eyes opened and rested on me with an expression of some disfavour.
"You're no afraid of giving me a relapse?" he inquired. "I've always heard sick folk shouldn't be troubled overmuch. It sets them back."
"You have a doctor right here," I assured him. "If you pass out from the strain, I'll know what to do about it."
"That's what I'm afraid of."
His narrowed gaze flicked to the little case of drugs and hypodermics on the table, then back to me.
"My arse feels like I've sat in a gorse bush with no breeks on."
"Good," I said pleasantly. "You'll get another one in an hour. Right now you're going to talk." His lips pressed tight together, but then relaxed as he sighed. He pushed himself laboriously upright against the pillows, one-handed. I didn't help him.
"All right," he said at last.
He didn't look at me, but down at the quilt, where his finger traced the edge of the starred design.
"Well, it was when I'd come back from England."
He had come up from the Lake District and over the Carter's Bar, that great ridge of high ground that divides England from Scotland, on whose broad back the ancient courts and markets of the borders had been held.
"There's a stone there to mark the border. Maybe you'll know. It looks the sort of stone to last a while."
He glanced at me, questioning, and I nodded. I did know it. A huge menhir, some 10 feet tall. In my time, someone had carved on its one face England, and on the other, Scotland. There he stopped to rest, as thousands of travellers had stopped over the years, his exiled past behind him, the future and home below and beyond, past the hazy green hollows of the lowlands, up into the grey crags of the highlands, hidden by fog. His good hand ran back and forth through his hair, as it always did when he thought, leaving the cowlicks on top standing up in small, bright whorls.
"You'll not know how it is to live among strangers for so long."
"Won't I?" I said with some sharpness. He glanced up at me, startled, then smiled faintly, looking down at the coverlet.
"Aye, maybe you will," he said. "You change, no? Much as you want to keep the memories of home and who ye are, you're changed. Not one of the strangers, you could never be that, even if you wanted to, but different from who you were, too."
I thought of myself, standing silent beside Frank, a bit of flotsam in the eddies of university parties, pushing a pram through the chilly parks of Boston, playing bridge and talking with other wives and mothers, speaking the foreign language of middle-class domesticity. Strangers, indeed.
"Yes," I said. "I know. Get on."
He sighed, rubbing his nose with a forefinger.
"So I came back," he said.
He looked up, a smile hidden in the corner of his mouth.
"What is it you told wee Ian? Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in."
"That's it," I said. "It's a quotation from a poet called Frost."
"But what do you mean? Surely your family was glad to see you?"
He frowned, fingering the quilt.
"Aye, they were," he said slowly. "It's not that. I didn't mean they made me feel unwelcome, not at all. But I'd been away so long. Michael and wee Janet and Ian. Didn't even remember me."
He smiled ruefully.
"They'd heard about me, though. When I came into the kitchen, they'd squash back against the walls and stare at me with their eyes gone round.
He leaned forward a little, intent on making me understand.
See, it was different when I hid in the cave. I wasn't in the house, and they seldom saw me, but I was always here. I was always part of them. I hunted for them. I kent when they were hungry or cold, or when the goats were ill or the kale crop poor, or a new draught under the kitchen door. Then I went to prison, he said abruptly, and to England. I wrote to them and they to me, but it canna be the same to see a few black words on the paper telling things that happened months before. And when I came back, he shrugged, wincing as the movement jarred his arm. It was different. Ian would ask me what I thought of fencing in old Kirby's pasture, but I know he'd already set young Jamie to do it. I'd walk through the fields and folk would squint at me, suspicious, thinking me a stranger. Then their eyes would go big as they'd seen a ghost when they knew me.
He stopped, looking out at the window where the brambles of his mother's rose beat against the glass as the wind changed.
I was a ghost, I think.
He glanced at me shyly.
If you ken what I mean.
Maybe, I said. Rain was streaking the glass with drops the same grey as the sky outside.
You feel like your ties to the earth are broken, I said softly,
floating through rooms without feeling your footsteps, hearing people speak to you and not making sense of it. I remember that, before Bree was born. But I had had one tie then. I had her to anchor me to life. He nodded, not looking at me, and then was quiet for a minute. The peat fire hissed on the hearth behind me, smelling of the highlands, and the rich scent of cockaliki and baking bread spread through the house, warm and comforting as a blanket.
I was here, he said softly, but not home.
I could feel the pull of it around me, the house, the family, the place itself. I, who couldn't remember a childhood home, felt the urge to sit down here and stay forever, enmeshed in the thousand strands of daily life, bound securely to this bit of earth. What would it have meant to him, who had lived all his life in the strength of that bond, endured his exile in the hope of coming back to it, and then arrived to find himself still rootless?
And I suppose I was lonely, he said quietly.
He lay still on the pillow, eyes closed.
I suppose you were, I said, careful to let no tone either of sympathy or condemnation show. I knew something of loneliness too.
He opened his eyes then and met my gaze with a naked honesty.
Aye, there was that too, he said. Not the main thing, no, but aye. That too.
Jenny had tried, with varying degrees of gentleness and insistence, to persuade him to marry again. She had tried intermittently since the days after Culloden, presenting first one and then another personable young widow, this and that sweet-tempered virgin, all to no avail. Now, bereft of the feelings that had sustained him so far, desperately seeking some sense of connection, he had listened.
Lyra was married to Hugh Mackenzie, one of Colum's taxmen, he said, eyes closed once more. Hugh was killed at Culloden, though, and 2 years later, Lyra married Simon McKimmy of Clan Fraser. The two lasses, Marsali and June, they're his. The English arrested him a few years later and took him to prison in Edinburgh.
He opened his eyes, looking up at the dark ceiling beams overhead.
He had a good house and property worth seizing. That was enough to make a Highland man a traitor then, whether he'd fought for the Stuarts openly or not.
His voice was growing hoarse, and he stopped to clear his throat.
Simon wasn't as lucky as I was. He died in prison before they could bring him to trial. The Crown tried for some time to take the estate, but Ned Gowan went to Edinburgh and spoke for Lyra, and he managed to save the main house and a little money, claiming it was her dower right.
Ned Gowan? I spoke with mingled surprise and pleasure. He can't still be alive, surely. It was Ned Gowan,
a small and elderly solicitor who advised the Mackenzie clan on legal matters, who had saved me from being burned as a witch 20 years before. I had thought him quite ancient then.
Jamie smiled, seeing my pleasure.
Why, I expect they'll have to knock him on the head with an axe to kill him. He looks just the same as he always did, though he must be past 70 now.
Does he still live at Castle Leoch?
He nodded, reaching to the table for the tumbler of water. He drank awkwardly, right-handed, and set it back.
What's left of it? Aye, though he's travelled a great deal these last years, appealing treason cases and filing lawsuits to recover property.
Jamie's smile had a bitter edge.
There's a saying, aye. After a war, first come the Corbies to eat the flesh, and then the lawyers to pick the bones.
His right hand went to his left shoulder, massaging it unconsciously.
No, he's a good man, is Ned, in spite of his profession. He goes back and forth to Inverness, to Edinburgh, sometimes even to London or Paris. And he stops here from time to time to break his journey.
It was Ned Gowan who had mentioned Lyra to Jenny, returning from Balriggan to Edinburgh. Pricking up her ears, Jenny had inquired for further details, and finding these satisfactory, had at once sent an invitation to Balriggan for Lyra and her two daughters to come to Lallybroch for Hogmanay, which was near. The house was bright that night, with candles lit in the windows, and bunches of holly and ivy fixed to the staircase and the doorposts. There were not so many pipers in the Highlands as there had been before Culloden, but one had been found, and a fiddler as well. And music floated up the stairwell, mixed with the heady scent of rum punch, plum cake, almond squirts, and Savoy biscuits. Jamie had come down late and hesitant. Many people here he hadn't seen in nearly 10 years, and he wasn't eager to see them now, feeling changed and distant as he did. But Jenny had made him a new shirt, brushed and mended his coat, and combed his hair smooth and plaited it for him before going downstairs to see to the cooking. He had no excuse to linger, and at last had come down into the noise and swirl of the gathering.
"Mr. Fraser!"
Peggy Gibbons was the first to see him. She hurried across the room, face glowing, and threw her arms about him, quite unabashed. Taken by surprise, he hugged her back, and within moments was surrounded by a small crowd of women, exclaiming over him, holding up small children born since his departure, kissing his cheeks and patting his hands. The men were shyer, greeting him with a gruff word of welcome or a slap on the back as he made his way slowly through the rooms, until, quite overwhelmed, he had escaped temporarily into the laird's study. Once his father's room, and then his own, it now belonged to his brother-in-law, who had run Lallybroch through the years of his absence. The ledgers and stock books and accounts were all lined up neatly on the edge of the battered desk. He ran a finger along the leather spines, feeling a sense of comfort at the touch. It was all in here, the planting and the harvests, the careful purchases and acquisitions, the slow accumulation and dispersals that were the rhythm of life to the tenants of Lallybroch. On the small bookshelf, he had found his wooden snake. Along with everything else of value, he had left it behind when he went to prison. A small icon carved of cherry wood, it had been the gift of his elder brother, dead in childhood. He was sitting in the chair behind the desk, stroking the snake's well-worn curves, when the door of the study opened.
"Jamie,"
she had said, hanging shyly back. He hadn't bothered to light a lamp in the study. She was silhouetted by the candles burning in the hall. She wore her pale hair loose like a maid, and the light shone through it, haloing her unseen face.
"You'll remember me, maybe?"
she had said, tentative, reluctant to come into the room without invitation.
"Aye," he said, after a pause. "Aye, of course I do."
"The music's starting,"
she said. It was. He could hear the whine of the fiddle and the stamp of feet from the front parlour, along with an occasional shout of merriment. It showed signs of being a good party already,
Most of the guests would be asleep on the floor come morning.
"Your sister says you're a bonny dancer," she said,
still shy but determined.
"It will have been some time since I tried," he said,
feeling shy himself and painfully awkward, though the fiddle music ached in his bones and his feet twitched at the sound of it.
"It's in the heather's my bed. You'll ken that one. Will you come and try wi' me?"
She had held out a hand to him, small and graceful in the half-dark, and he had risen, clasped her outstretched hand in his own, and taken his first steps in pursuit of himself.
"It was in here," he said,
waving his good hand at the room where we sat.
"Jenny had had the furniture cleared away, all but one table with the food and the whisky, and the fiddler stood by the window there, wi' a new moon over his shoulder."
He nodded at the window where the rose vine trembled. Something of the light of that Hogmanay feast lingered on his face, and I felt a small pang seeing it.
"We danced all that night, sometimes with others, but mostly with each other. And at the dawn, when those still awake went to the end of the house to see what omens the new year might bring, the two of us went too. The single women took it in turns to spin about and walk through the door with their eyes closed, then spin again, and open their eyes to see what the first thing they might see would be. For that tells them about the man they'll marry, you ken."
There had been a lot of laughter as the guests, heated by whisky and dancing, pushed and shoved at the door. Lyra had held back, flushed and laughing, saying it was a game for young girls and not for a matron of 34. But the others had insisted, and try she had. Spun three times clockwise and opened the door, stepped out into the cold dawnlight and spun again. And when she opened her eyes, they had rested on Jamie's face, wide with expectation.
So, there she was, a widow with two bairns. She needed a man, that was plain enough. I needed something.
He gazed into the fire where the low flame glimmered through the red mass of the peat. Heat without much light.
I suppose that we might help each other.
They had married quietly at Balriggan, and he had moved his few possessions there. Less than a year later, he had moved out again and gone to Edinburgh. "What on earth happened?" I asked, more than curious. He looked up at me, helpless.
"I canna say. It wasna that anything was wrong exactly, only that nothing was right."
He rubbed a hand tiredly between his brows.
"That was me, I think, my fault. I always disappointed her somehow. We'd sit down to supper, and all of a sudden the tears would well up in her eyes, and she'd leave the table sobbing, and me sitting there with not a notion what I'd done or said wrong."
His fist clenched on the coverlet, then relaxed.
"God, I never knew what would do for her, or what to say. Anything I said just made it worse, and there would be days, nay, weeks, when she'd not speak to me, but only turn away when I came near her, and stand staring out the window until I went away again."
His fingers went to the parallel scratches down the side of his neck. They were nearly healed now, but the marks of my nails still showed on his fair skin. He looked at me wryly.
"You never did that to me, Sassenach."
"Not my style," I agreed, smiling faintly. "If I'm mad at you, you'll bloody well know why, at least." He snorted briefly and lay back on his pillow. Neither of us spoke for a bit. Then he said, staring up at the ceiling,
"I thought I didn't want to hear anything about what it was like with Frank, I mean. I was maybe wrong about that."
"I'll tell you anything you want to know," I said, "but not just now. It's still your turn."
He sighed and closed his eyes.
"She was afraid of me,"
he said softly a minute later.
"I tried to be gentle with her. God, I tried again and again everything I knew to please a woman. But it was no use."
His head turned restlessly, making a hollow in the feather pillow.
"Maybe it was Hugh, or maybe Simon," I kent them both, and they were good men. But there's no telling what goes on in a marriage bed. Maybe it was bearing the children. Not all women can stand it. But something hurt her sometime, and I couldn't heal it for all my trying. She shrank away when I touched her, and I could see the sickness and the fear in her eyes. There were lines of sorrow around his own closed eyes, and I reached impulsively for his hand. He squeezed it gently and opened his eyes. "That's why I left, finally," he said softly. "I couldn't bear it any more." I didn't say anything, but went on holding his hand, putting a finger on his pulse to check it. His heartbeat was reassuringly slow and steady. He shifted slightly in the bed, moving his shoulders and making a grimace of discomfort as he did so. "Arm hurt a lot?" I asked.
"A bit."
I bent over him, feeling his brow. He was very warm, but not feverish. There was a line between the thick, ruddy brows, and I smoothed it with a knuckle.
"Headache?"
"Yes."
"I'll go and make you some willow bark tea."
I made to rise, but his hand on my arm stopped me.
"I didn't need tea," he said. "It would ease me, though, if maybe I could lay my head in your lap and have you rub my temples a bit."
Blue eyes looked up at me, limpid as a spring sky.
"You don't fool me a bit, Jamie Fraser," I said. "I'm not going to forget about your next shot."
Nonetheless, I was already moving the chair out of the way and sitting down beside him on the bed. He made a small grunting sound of content as I moved his head onto my lap and began to stroke it, rubbing his temples, smoothing back the thick, wavy mass of his hair. The back of his neck was damp. I lifted the hair away and blew softly on it, seeing the smooth, fair skin prickle into goose flesh at the nape of his neck.
"Ooh, that feels good," he murmured.
Despite my resolve not to touch him beyond the demands of caretaking until everything between us was resolved, I found my hands moulding themselves to the clean, bold lines of his neck and shoulders, seeking the hard knobs of his vertebrae and the broad, flat planes of his shoulder blades. He was firm and solid under my hands, his breath a warm caress on my thigh, and it was with some reluctance that I at last eased him back onto the pillow and reached for the ampoule of penicillin.
"All right," I said, turning back the sheet and reaching for the hem of his shirt. "A quick stick and you'll..."
My hand brushed over the front of his nightshirt, and I broke off, startled.
"Jamie," I said, amused, "you can't possibly..."
"I didn't suppose I can," he agreed comfortably.
He curled up on his side like a shrimp, his lashes dark against his cheek.
"But a man can dream, no?"
I didn't go upstairs to bed that night either. We didn't talk much. Just lay close together in the narrow bed, scarcely moving so as not to jar his injured arm. The rest of the house was quiet, everyone safely in bed, and there was no sound but the hissing of the fire, the sigh of the wind, and the scratch of Ellen's rosebush at the window, insistent as the demands of love.
"Do you know,"
he said softly, somewhere in the black small hours of the night,
"do you know what it's like to be with someone that way? To try all you can and seem never to have the secret of them?"
"Yes," I said, thinking of Frank. "Yes, I do know."
"I thought perhaps you did."
He was quiet for a moment, and then his hand touched my hair lightly, a shadowy blur in the firelight.
"And then," he whispered, "then to have it back again. That knowing, to be free in all you say or do, and know that it is right.
To say, 'I love you,' and mean it with all your heart," I said softly to the dark.
"Aye,"
he answered, barely audible,
"to see that."
His hand rested on my hair, and without knowing quite how it happened, I found myself curled against him, my head just fitting in the hollow of his shoulder.
"For so many years," he said, For so long I've been so many things, so many different men.
I felt him swallow, and he shifted slightly, the linen of his nightshirt rustling with starch.
I was uncle to Jenny's children, and brother to her and Ian, milor to Fergus, and sir to my tenants, MacDo to the men of Ardsmuir, and Mackenzie to the other servants at Hellwater, Malcolm the printer, then, and Jamie Roy at the docks.
The hand stroked my hair slowly with a whispering sound like the wind outside.
But here, he said,
so softly I could barely hear him.
Here, in the dark with you. I have no name.
I lifted my face toward his and took the warm breath of him between my own lips.
I love you, I said,
and didn't need to tell him how I meant it. Chapter 38. I Meet a Lawyer. As I had predicted, 18th century germs were no match for a modern antibiotic. Jamie's fever had virtually disappeared within 24 hours, and within the next 2 days the inflammation in his arm began to subside as well, leaving no more than a reddening about the wound itself, and a very slight oozing of pus when pressed. On the fourth day, after satisfying myself that he was mending nicely, I dressed the wound lightly with coneflower salve, bandaged it again, and left to dress and make my own toilet upstairs. Ian, Janet, young Ian, and the servants had all put their heads in at intervals over the last few days to see how Jamie progressed. Jenny had been conspicuously absent from these inquiries, but I knew that she was still entirely aware of everything that happened in her house. I hadn't announced my intention of coming upstairs, yet when I opened the door to my bedroom, there was a large pitcher of hot water standing by the ewer, gently steaming, and a fresh cake of soap laid alongside it. I picked it up and sniffed. Fine-milled French soap, perfumed with lily of the valley. It was a delicate comment on my status in the household. Honoured guest, to be sure, but not one of the family, who would all make do, as matter of course, with the usual coarse soap made of tallow and lye. Right, I muttered. Well, we'll see, won't we? And lathered the cloth for washing. As I was arranging my hair in the glass a half hour later, I heard the sounds below of someone arriving. Several someones, in fact, from the sounds of it. I came down the stairs to find a small mob of children in residence, streaming in and out of the kitchen and front parlour, with here and there a strange adult visible in the midst of them, who stared curiously at me as I came down the stairs. Entering the parlour, I found the camp bed put away, and Jamie, shaved and in a fresh nightshirt, neatly propped up on the sofa under a quilt, with his left arm in a sling, surrounded by four or five children. These were shepherded by Janet, young Ian, and a smiling young man who was a Fraser of sorts by the shape of his nose, but otherwise bore only the faintest resemblances to the tiny boy I had seen last at Lallybroch 20 years before. "There she is," Jamie exclaimed with pleasure at my appearance, and the entire roomful of people turned to look at me, with expressions ranging from pleasant greeting to gape-mouthed awe. "You'll remember young Jamie," the elder Jamie said, nodding to the tall, broad-shouldered young man with curly black hair and a squirming bundle in his arms. "I remember the curls," I said, smiling. "The rest has changed a bit." Young Jamie grinned down at me. "I remember ye well, auntie," he said, in a deep brown voice like well-aged ale. "Ye held me on your knee and played 10 wee piggies wi' my toes." "I can't possibly have," I said, looking up at him in some dismay. While it seemed to be true that people really didn't change markedly in appearance between their 20s and their 40s, they most assuredly did so between 4 and 24. "Perhaps you can have a go wee wee Benjamin here," young Jamie suggested with a smile. "Maybe the knack of it will come back to you." He bent and carefully laid his bundle in my arms. A very round face looked up at me with that air of befuddlement so common to new babies. Benjamin appeared mildly confused at having me suddenly exchanged for his father, but didn't object.